The play-in seeds have been determined after the Heat and Grizzlies won their play-in games. They get the 8 seed in their respective conferences. I'm not expecting either of those teams to win their matchup. I don't think they're going to even win a game. I'm picking 2 sweeps in favor of Cleveland and Oklahoma City, but congrats to them for actually making the postseason here. We'll be talking more in the coming weeks and months when we're covering the draft about some of those teams and what the ripple effects are of them falling where they are in the draft. But for today, we're talking playoffs, players specifically, because we're ranking my top 40 players in the postseason. From number 40 to number 1, the best postseason players. Now, with some of these guys, they're favored because they've been there. They've done that. They're veterans. Other guys are unproven. They got something to show in the postseason. We went through all of that with some key stats, some stuff to watch for in the playoffs as well. I want to get your feedback as well. So make sure you comment on this video either on social or on Spotify or YouTube, wherever you're watching it. I want to get your feedback. Who's too high? Who's too low? Who's going to be the biggest riser? Let's get to it, starting with number 40 right after this. It's NBA playoff time, so let's get into my top 40 playoff players. I'm factoring in recent success here and past playoff performance. So this is going to favor some of the proven guys that have been here before, that have done it in the postseason. And with some of the younger guys, it's just projection. We haven't seen them do it, or they need to prove doubts. So we're going to get into a lot of those topics. Give this video a thumbs up and comment below with your biggest agreements, your biggest disagreements. And let's start off with number 40. Amen Thompson leads my list at number 40, and he's got a chance to rise after Rockets make a run here, and we know what he's going to do. He's going to excel defensively. He held Stephen Curry to just 3 points only a couple weeks ago. It's one of the best performances I've ever seen any individual defender have against an opponent, and Amen did it all year long. He did it against SGA. Of course, everybody saw the highlight of him blocking his shot. He did it against every opponent because Houston always had him on the opponent's best scorer, and he got my vote as defensive player of the year. I don't care, he's just in his second year. But when Amen was the nearest defender this season, opponent shot 9.7 worse within 6 feet of the rim, 9.5 worse within 10 feet of the rim, 5.5 worse beyond 15 feet. That's hard to do, but Amen blocked nearly the most jumpers in the whole NBA. He's a menace off ball. He's a one-man fast break stopper, and he defended the opponent's best player every single night. With him, the question's going to be, what happens to his offense? What happens to him there? We know he averaged 14 points, 4 assists per game. He's a superhuman athlete. He shot over 70% in the restricted area. He's a downhill attacker. Those are the things that he does. He's a good passer on top of that, too. But he only had an effective field goal percentage of 40.1 outside of the restricted area. Will that become an issue in the playoffs? Or will it become something that, like during the whole regular season, it was just a forgettable flaw for him? My bet is it's not going to matter as much, which is why he's in my top 40. And I think he has a chance to end up way higher by the time the playoffs are over with. Coming up next at number 39, Darius Garland. If I made this list before the playoffs, Garland would have been way higher. But since he had his injury against the Knicks, a really hard fall, a couple days after the All-Star break back in February, 18.2 points per game, 33.5% from three, 47.4% from two. He's looked really good last two games of the regular season against the Bulls and the Knicks, so he still belongs in the top 40. So this ranking here, it's with the caveat that he might skyrocket if he stays healthy like he did against the Knicks and the Bulls. He looked good because he's a skilled playmaker. He's a skilled shot creator. He's one of the most clutch players in all of the league. He's an underrated candidate, in my opinion, for clutch player of the year. Not that anybody really cares about that award. But with him, he's still in the 30s, even if he were thriving on offense, because I still worry about the size. Our team's going to attack him. In the early rounds, I don't think this is going to matter quite as much in a 1-8 or even in the second round. But if you're talking Boston in the NBA conference finals or a potential NBA finals matchup, teams are going to go after Garland. That's the big question he's going to have to answer. Coming up next, don't turn off the video. Rudy Gobert comes in at number 38. I know you think he stinks. I know the moments. I know he gets turned around by Stephen Curry on the perimeter. That was like a decade ago at this point. He's a way better perimeter defender now. We know these things. We know the flaws with Gobert. We know he's not a creator outside of the rim. We know he can't do anything off the dribble. But there's no denying this guy's defensive presence. There's no denying what he can do. Ever since he got back from injury after the All-Star break, his final 17 games, the Minnesota Timberwolves had a 118.6 defensive rating without him. That stinks. That'd be bottom of the league. It's horrible. It's Wizards, Hornets level. And they had a 105.6 defensive rating with him on the floor, which is just absolutely outstanding. Rudy makes that much of a difference. He's an elite paint protector. And with Minnesota, now you look at what happened in the past with Utah at times. He gets pulled to the perimeter. He's one-on-one on an island. They have Joe Ingles as a help defender. Donovan Mitchell as a help defender. Minnesota has more size and versatility behind Rudy when he's going to inevitably get pulled on the perimeter. It's going to happen against the Lakers in the first round. LeBron, Luka, Austin Reeves. These guys are going to try to pull Rudy away from the rim and have him on the perimeter. But that's not because he's a bad perimeter defender. He's actually become a good perimeter defender. It's just he's an all-time great rim protector, and they want that guy away from the basket, and they want McDaniels or Edwards or somebody else in help instead. So with Gobert, elite defender, shot over 70% at the rim, dunks everything, elite screener, elite lob threat, elite rebounder. Gobert belongs in the top 40, whether you like him or not, all right? Next up, I think this next guy does as well. Draymond Green comes in at number 37. This dude doesn't score at all. He's not very good at scoring either. We saw him botch a layup in a must-win game for the Warriors, but there's no denying how important Draymond Green is. Everybody's seen this guy do it throughout the postseason for years. Connective playmaker, the chemistry he has with Stephen Curry, the shots he creates for him, that alone elevates Steph. And it elevates his own value. He's important for the Warriors offensively, even if he doesn't score. Never mind his defense. He's an all-defensive caliber player. And ever since the Warriors got Butler, he looked more like a defensive player of the year, which is why I think with the recency bias kicking in, he's going to get a lot of defensive player of the year votes. Opponents shot 9% worse within 6 feet of the rim when Draymond was nearby since they got Butler. 9.6% worse within 10 feet. Those are defensive player of the year caliber numbers, very similar to what I just shared earlier involving Amen Thompson. But it was only the second half of the year. That's all that matters to the Warriors, is that he carries that on into the postseason in a first-round series against the Rockets. They need him on the floor. He belongs in the top 40. Up next, number 36, Jaren Jackson Jr., JJJ. Hasn't done much in his playoff career. You might be really surprised by this low ranking, but look, in his postseason career, 15.7 points, only 33.6% from three. At the time, he was less of a shot creator than he is now, but big game against the Warriors in the first play-in game, absolute zero as a creator. He's had a lot of games like that. And of course, he's an elite defender. He belongs in these all-defensive teams and everything. But he sucks at rebounding, non-factor on the boards. And even in that Warriors play-in game, he's getting back cut. Like, that's, to me, that's not the Jaren Jackson Jr. that won Defensive Player of the Year in the past. So, you know, first round against Oklahoma City, like, Memphis is going to get smoked. I think I don't like their chances. But this is an opportunity for him to show, like, hey, this ranking's too low. I'm better than that. I've developed offensively, and my defense is still legit, still awesome. We'll see. Coming up at number 35, Magic fans are going to hate me for this one. Paolo Banchero at number 35. I'm sorry, Magic fans. I know he had a strong third-year leap, 25.9 points per game. He had these elite stretches, like especially that mid-March to early April stretch. He's averaging 30. He looked incredible. But like the stinkers that he's had, 6 of 17 versus Boston a couple weeks ago, 4 of 13 against Atlanta in the play-in, and all year long, efficiency was a major, 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 major problem for Paolo Banchero. Let's just be honest here. The jumper's not where it needs to be. The decision-making isn't where it needs to be. And even that rim finishing, sometimes I feel like a guy at his size with his athleticism should be even more dominant. So, look, I had Paolo number one in his draft class in a year where some people had Jabari Smith, who went to Houston. Some people had Chet Holmgren, who went to Oklahoma City. I was a Banchero guy. I want Banchero to be great. I want to be right about having him ranked number one. But like, I just think with this guy right now, we're going to see it in this postseason. He looks the part a lot of the time. But for Magic fans who don't have a lot of scoring, a lot of three-point shooting, I think it makes Paolo look more amazing than he actually is right now. In reality, for the Magic, they need someone to score, and a lot of the times that guy is Paolo. I don't want to say he's a good stats, bad team player. I'm not saying that. I think Paolo's better than that. But I think this postseason is going to put into light the things that he needs to get better at: shooting, decision-making, and defense. And I hope that experience is good for him. Coming up at number 34, Franz Wagner. Wagner, in my opinion, is very clearly better than Paolo Banchero. Wagner is the better defender. Wagner is the better passer. Wagner is the better decision-maker. Wagner is the better mover without the ball. Wagner has better touch. The issue with both of these guys is neither of them can shoot threes. Franz just can't shoot threes yet. And I got a stat I looked up earlier today, because of the players in NBA history to try over 5 threes per game and make under 30% of those threes and make over 80% of their free throws, only 3 guys have done it. Franz did it this year, Michael Adams back in 1991, and then Jordan Clarkson in 23-24. So Wagner, Clarkson, and Adams are the only 3 guys in NBA history that'd be high-volume three-point shooters that don't make a lot of threes but are elite free-throw shooters. Wagner's got to figure it out, because it's just so stupid right now. He's an elite touch player from the free-throw line and in. He just can't make jumpers. I don't know if it's mental. I don't know if it's something with his fundamentals, but it's the skill that holds him back from being definitely on the top 20 of this list, because he's got everything else. Coming in at number 33, Aaron Gordon. Aaron Gordon, for all of the shaky stuff this year in Denver, Gordon was a bright spot. Still an elite defender, going to be like really important against Kawhi Leonard in the first round with that Nuggets-Clippers series. And then offensively, Gordon this year, 14.7 points per game. Did a lot of the same old stuff, scoring off of cuts, off of post-ups with little mismatches, using power or a turnaround jumper, transition, and of course he's got the telepathic chemistry with Nikola Jokic with those cuts and everything he does. But now, Gordon, 43.6% from three and 81% from the line, both career highs. Are you buying that? I am. Because this is a guy that's worked on his shot a lot. He's always had touch near the basket on those like floater in between shots, touch layups and all that. And I think something clicked for him, either mentally or something with his hands, the way he's shooting the ball, that has led to better results both from the line and both from from 3-point range. And so we have one of the best glue guys in the NBA, a former champion who is now looking like an elite, or at least a highly reliable shooter. And he's a proven playoff performer. One of the keys to the Nuggets, belongs in the top 40, and I have him at number 33. Let's move on to number 32 with a fairly unproven guy. Alperen Şengün is at number 32 in my top 40. What a year for Şengün. First-time All-Star, 19-10-5 offensively, and then defensively made a big leap. That's really why he became an All-Star. That's why he was named a reserve by coaches, because they recognized, okay, the Rockets have a top 5 defense, and Şengün is no longer a weak link. He's an elite rebounder, but he's also become a very good positional defender. And with that said, the Warriors are going to target him. They're going to pull him out to the perimeter. They're going to test his mobility. They're going to try to make things really hard on him defensively. And this is a chance for him to show, okay, not only am I an All-Star, but I should have been on everybody's All-NBA ballots, including mine. I left Şengün off. Maybe that'll turn out to be a mistake. Maybe it'll look stupid. It might. He was on the borderline, in my opinion. And right now, he still needs to prove some things. And so for him, defensively, we'll see what he does. Offensively, no questions about what he does. He's like Jokic light, post-hub around the elbows. He uses speed. He can play with bully ball as well. The Şengün Adams lineup, that's going to be something I'm watching for in the postseason here, because that size in the front court next to him, it might present issues for Houston offensively, but defensively, Adams, Şengün, they They inhale everything, over 50% of offensive board opportunities those guys grab. And defensively, those dudes are just amazing together. Adams, like, what is he, 29 years old, but it feels like he's 40. Him and Sengun together is one of the best and funnest two-man lineups in all of basketball. So I'm rooting for Sengun to rise up these rankings, but he's still a postseason unknown. Coming in at number 31, we get OG Anunoby. The Knicks defense is at its best thanks to OG. Versatility, length, toughness, intensity. Everybody knows OG's awesome. The question is, what version of OG Anunoby are the Knicks actually going to get on offense? Are they going to get this very reliable spot-up shooter? And that's about it. 37.6% on catch-and-shoot threes, attacks closeouts, makes the simple pass. Are we going to get that version of OG? Or are we going to get the version of OG Anunoby that's doing spin moves and attacking the basket and dunking at the rim, showing off in front of Suni Lee? Are we going to get that guy? Because if we get that guy, the Knicks actually have a real chance to make a deep run. But they can't just have OG be some highly paid 3-and-D guy. OG is capable of more of that, and I think the Knicks really showed that during that stretch Jalen Brunson was out, but we'll see what version of the Knicks get. Maybe OG belongs in somewhere in the 20s. Maybe he belongs somewhere more in the 40s. But for now, I feel good with him at number 31. Coming in at number 30, Ivica Zubats. Zubats made third-team All-NBA for me this season. That was not a hard choice either because defensively, Zubats, dude, this guy is absolutely dominant in the interior. He's one of the best defensive rebounders in basketball. Opponent shot 9% worse on shots taken within 6 feet of the rim when Zubats was nearby. He's a rock-solid post defender, and I can't wait to see him battle Jokic round one, one-on-one, those two. Are the Clippers going to have to send help, or are they going to defend one-on-one against Jokic? That's going to be a tactical thing that I'm watching for above all else. It's just going to be fun, straight up fun to watch those two either. But offensively, is where Zubats has also taken a leap. He had a league-leading 300 offensive boards, grabs everything around the basket, and he's a great decision-maker off of those boards. He can go up for finishes, or he can look for kickouts. He doesn't take a lot of dumb shots off of those offensive boards, and that's because he's an amazing finisher, and he's a really good passer. He made 73% of his layups, excluding tip-ins this season. He shot 59.3% on hook shots and runners. Those are those little in-between shots off of an offensive board, putting it back up over his left shoulder, or it's a post-up when he's sealing off the defender inside. It doesn't matter the situation. Zubats has touch inside, and he's been pivotal in the two-man game stuff with James Harden. He sets unbelievable screens. He can operate out of the short roll as a passer or put the ball on the floor once or twice to get to the rim for a finish. And it shows in the numbers because the Clippers this year, plus 8.9 net rating with him on the floor, minus 4.3 without him. The Clippers need Zubats to stay on the floor to have any chance. And moving forward, we'll see. We'll see how he ends up getting attacked because he might be somebody that we see teams attack and try to pull out the perimeter and disturb that Clippers defense. Coming in at number 29, we get Austin Reeves because it's official. Reeves is a 20-point-per-game guy, and he's doing it. He's doing it on a high volume, high efficiency, 61.6 true shooting this past season. Fits absolutely perfectly next to Luka and LeBron as the third star because off ball, when Luka and LeBron are running the show, Reeves makes 40% of his catch and shoot threes. Everybody knows he's a smart cutter. He can use screens as well. On ball, though, 83rd percentile in pick and roll, 80th percentile in isolation scoring. So when they need Reeves to score, he can provide that. When they need Reeves to play off ball, he can do that as well. And in the 561 minutes without Luka or LeBron, the Lakers are a plus 8.8 with Reeves on the floor. So I think you could argue that he should be higher because of his development. But for now, considering he's a third guy, he still needs to fill gaps as a off ball guy and as a defender where he's okay, but not great. That's why he's at number 29 right now. But his improvement all year has him way higher than people would have had him last year or the year prior to that. Coming in at number 28, we got Drew Holiday. Drew is still, even at his advanced age right now, one of the league's best defenders. Super versatile on offense as well. Celtics use him as an on-ball screener. He rolls into the paint sometimes. They use him as a cutter. He hangs around the dunker spot. And I think, you know, with Drew, I was considering having him outside of my top 40 this year because he's not a creator necessarily. And his 3-point percentage this year was only 35.3, a little bit lower than it was last year in the playoffs, a little bit lower than it was last year during the season as well. But that number is a little deceiving because he shot 39.5% on catch and shoot threes. The number is just lower because of those one dribble sidestep types of threes. A guy blows by him on a closeout, then he takes a side dribble. That's why the number's lower, but still 39.5% on straight up catch and shoot threes, which is the large chunk of the shots he takes. I'm not worried about the shot entering the playoffs for the Celtics. He's still a key role player and those types of guys. I'm favoring on this list. I'm favoring these super important glue guys rather than some of these inefficient chuckers. These role players are the guys that elevate stars that can help a team actually win championship basketball. So that's why they're a bit higher on my list. And that's true also with this next guy. Coming in at number 27, Derek White. Derek White, the same old indispensable role player we saw for the Celtics during their finals run last year. An elite guard shot blocker, an elite point of attack defender, brings energy. He's attentive. He's aware. He's an anchor for this Celtics defense. And offensively, dude's still an elite shooter. He's still an elite shooter. And he is not just a spot up catch and shoot guy either, because look at the stat here. This season, he ranks second behind his own teammate, Peyton Pritchard, with scoring efficiency off screens. 1.5 points per screen for Derek White. That's an elite mark ahead of some big name guys like Jokic, Anthony Edwards, and of course, he's a secondary creator as well. He's not just an off-screen guy. He's somebody the Celtics that can use on the ball as well. And that's going to be important for them because Jaylen Brown could miss time or could be limited, and that might mean a higher usage for Derek White. Coming in at number 26, we get Jamal Murray. Obviously, a super proven playoff performer in his postseason career, 24-6-5. And even if he has a crappy game, he still seems to always come up clutch like he did against the Lakers last year. He's got elite chemistry with Jokic. He belongs in the top 30, but he's not totally healthy. So I can't put him higher. I think he'd be in the top 20 considering his postseason success in the past if he just looked like that version of Jamal Murray, but he hasn't looked like that guy all year. It's been a rocky season for him, way out of shape to begin the season. He's been hurt recently. Before Michael Malone was fired, he said Murray might not even come back. And in the couple of games that he did play, he didn't look like his full self. So I get Murray at 26, but if he looks healthy, and you know, Adelman did say before the playoffs that Murray's been moving well during their week off, Murray could definitely move up this list very, very quickly. But for now, 26 feels safe. Coming in at number 25, we got Bam Adebayo. Bam, of course, did not have quite the season he expected, both individually and as a team. But there are still some positive signs of progress with him. He started shooting threes. He made 35.7% of his 2.8 three-pointers per game. Miami is still a top 10 defense as well, and that's in large part because of him, his versatility, the rim protection he provides, the versatility going out on the perimeter, roaming around as a help guy with that Khalil Ware, Bam Adebayo front court we saw with two bigs. He belongs in the 20s right now, and maybe he could move into the top 20 again next season. Coming in at number 24, Chet Holmgren. Okay, statistically, nobody was better at protecting the rim than Chet this season. Opponents shot 18% worse on shots within 6 feet when Chet was around. Elite rim protection. Maybe he's not the best. Obviously, you'd put Victor Wembanyama as a pure shot blocker ahead of him and some others as well. But maybe not. Like, Chet's really freaking good, dude. He's an elite rim protector, without a doubt. And he's got some versatility to go out on the perimeter as well. I like the Thunder experimenting with those Isaiah Hartenstein, Chet Holmgren front courts. That's going to benefit them, in my opinion, come postseason time. Chet's a good rebounder. He's a great defender. Offensively, that's the question with him. What is Chet going to be offensively? This season, he made 37.9% of his threes, very comparable to what he did his rookie year. But then last year, his postseason three-point percentage dropped to 26%. So is Chet going to struggle to shoot like he did last time around with OKC, or is he going to continue to be a near 40% guy? That's important for Oklahoma City because they get a lot of those guys with questions like that. Lu Dort, Cason Wallace, Alex Caruso. These guys, are they regular season shooters or are they postseason performers? That's the question with Chet. And if he's not shooting the ball well, can he compensate by offering some creation? He logged only 26 shots out of isolations or post-ups this season. I don't expect that to change. They got Jalen Williams, who's coming up right now on this list. Chet's got more room to grow. That's too much to ask right now. But because of his defense, because of his hopeful three-point shooting percentages, he still belongs in the top 25. Jalen Williams comes in at number 23. I had Jalen Williams as a third-team All-NBA player this season because he's just unbelievable defensively. Lou Dort, it's kind of funny. Lou Dort's the guy, and I favor Lou Dort on my ballot. I had both of them first-team All-Defense. But Jalen Williams is arguably the better defender. Jalen Williams, outstanding on ball. He's versatile, and he's one of the best rim protectors at his position. Opponent shot 11% worse when Jalen Williams was in the area around the paint. 11%. Remember some of the numbers I've shared earlier? 9% for Draymond Green. I just said 18% for Chet Holmgren. Most guys are not above 10%. Every other player above 10% was a big, not a wing like Jalen Williams. So we know he'll bring it on defense in the playoffs. But offensively, that's the question. He averaged 29 points and 7 assists per 75 possessions without Shai Gilgeous-Alexander on the floor this season. Can he carry the load when SGA sits, or is his production going to slip like it did last year? That's the big question for OKC. Everybody wonders who's going to be their second scorer. I hope it's Jalen Williams, but no guarantees. All I know is if he does thrive, he's going to move way up this list. Like, it's going to happen fast. Coming in at number 22, we got Damian Lillard. Turns out he's going to be back, which is good for Milwaukee, in my opinion. It's just a matter of when he comes back. He's going to miss game one this weekend, but he will be back at some point during the first round because of the treatment he underwent for that blood clot. And I think this is good news, even though Giannis is playing better than he has all season long. They've just put shooters around him, defenders around him, and he looks awesome. The Bucks won 8 in a row heading into the playoffs. Giannis played in 6 of those. And I don't think that philosophy should change. Dame's got to take a back seat here, focus on his elite shooting ability, focus on moving on ball off ball more like he did in Portland, and then pick his spots as a creator. And with him, it's really the same questions. Is he going to be an issue defensively? Is he going to hurt Milwaukee defensively? Is he going to hurt will he hurt their flow offensively? I'm feeling optimistic about their offense. The defense is a question, though. He's going to have to hold his own. Coming in at number 21, we got Jaylen Brown. He enters this postseason banged up with a bone bruise on his knee, and he did not look anywhere near what he did last year for Boston as of late, or even earlier in the season. So he ranks a lot lower than you might expect for a finals MVP, but frankly, like, the dude just wasn't the same guy offensively. All year long. He just wasn't. He had the worst three-point percentage of his entire career. Defenses are going to be daring somebody to shoot on Boston. They're probably going to try Jrue Holiday. I think that'll bite them. They're probably going to try Jaylen Brown. Remember when the Warriors did that a couple years ago and he made like 8 threes in the first quarter or something like that? Maybe he'll make them pay, but Jaylen did only make 32.4% of catch-and-shoot threes this season, also only 35.8% of dribble jumpers. He's got to be better shooting the ball. It's nice that he improved as a passer. It's nice that he's still really good defensively, but the shooting does need to improve. Defensively is what's most important, though, for Boston. What he did against Luka last year in the finals is partially why he won finals MVP. They need him to be healthy. They need him to be effective. Coming in at number 20, Kristaps Porzingis. Kristaps is the X factor for the Boston Celtics, and he's so much more than just a rim protector. He is so much more than just a 7-footer who shoots threes at over 40% this season. His post play, Kristaps Porzingis on the post, is so often overlooked because you think about early in his career, Celtics fans have vivid memories of Marcus Smart, little guy, compared to KP, defending Kristaps Porzingis and Porzingis unable to move him, unable to create quality shots. In the years since, of course, KP has been a dominant post player. Of the 25 players to log the most post-ups over the last 3 seasons combined, KP is number 1 in the NBA, 1.26 points per post-up on 3.9 attempts per game. That's way more efficiency-wise than guys like Giannis, Kat, AD, Sabonis. And if you plot everybody, You get Embiid as an outlier with efficiency and volume. And then Jokic, who obviously best post player in the NBA. But KP's got elite efficiency, number one in the NBA, because he can use power. He can shoot over the top at 7'3", and he passes well out of the post as well. He's a good decision maker. He changed his game on the post his year in Washington, and he's carried it in with Boston the 2 years since. And the fact the Celtics have this weapon on top of everything else, we haven't even gotten to all their players yet, on top of everything else, Kristaps Porzingis staying healthy could be the thing that makes them absolutely unbeatable and put them on their way to going back-to-back this year. So KP's going to stay healthy, especially if Jaylen Brown is not himself. But the dude's dominant, and to me, he's an easy choice in the top 20. You could argue he belongs higher when he's healthy. Number 19, Pascal Siakam. To me, Siakam's underrated. That's my main thought with him. Siakam is underrated. We saw this guy win a title in Toronto when he was a role player, like a 3-and-D style guy. He's become more of a do-it-all guy since then. And listen to these numbers. This season, he shot 52% on isolations, 55% out of the post, 51% on drives to the rim, 39% on catch and shoot threes, not over 50% for everything, 39% on catch and shoot threes. That's because the Pacers use him in so many different ways. Sometimes he's a supporting player next to guards. He sets screens for Tyrese Haliburton. He spots up in the corner. Other times he's a shot creator. He's creating offense for Indiana. And on top of that, he's a good, versatile defender as well. The dude's awesome. I love Pascal Siakam. And for him personally, as an individual player, this Indiana-Milwaukee first-round series, he's going to be the primary defender against Giannis Antetokounmpo. It's going to be a chance for everybody to see how great he is. Coming in at number 18, we got Cade Cunningham. Cade, my most improved player of the year. That was a controversial pick. A lot of people thought it was silly considering his stats didn't move a lot. But when you go from the 50th or the 75th, however you would have rated him last year, he was not a top 50 guy. If you go from that to All-NBA, in my opinion, that's a bigger jump than what Dyson Daniels did. It's a bigger jump than what Christian Brown did and what some of the other candidates did. Because going from the 70th best player to the 15th best regular season player, or whatever you want to say, that's a massive leap. His efficiency got better. His decision-making got better. His defense got better. And he is the key reason why the Pistons got 30 wins better. Those are regular season honors, though. Those are regular season honors. This is the playoffs. Cade needs to prove it in the playoffs. So what I'll be watching for are two really key things here. During the season, he made 50.4% of pull-up twos and 33.3% of pull-up threes. Those are good numbers. How does his jumper translate? And number two, he made 52.6% of shots at the rim. That's solid, not great. How does it translate in the postseason in the first round against the Knicks' 13th ranked defense? Can he get to the rim, and can he finish with effectiveness at the rim? During the regular season in four games against the Knicks, it looked great. He averaged 30.8 points per game in those four games against the Knicks with a slash line of 56, 52, 80. Cade was dominant. I like his chances to move up these rankings quite quickly. At number 17, Karl Anthony Towns. Towns' defense last year changed a lot of the narrative about him. What he did against Jokic man-to-man in that Minnesota series win over Denver, that showed a lot. But what will he do as a center? Because with the Knicks, are they going to have to go with two bigs? Are they going to play him next to Mitchell Robinson more often? Will he be able to survive as just the lone center on the floor a lot of the times? That's a big question for him. And then offensively, the self-proclaimed greatest big man shooter in the history of basketball. Shout out Dirk Nowitzki, the real best 7-footer shooter ever. Towns has shot 40% career from three during the regular season, but that's dipped to 35% in the playoffs. Got to be better to be the GOAT 7-foot shooter. You got to be better in the playoffs. So Karl Anthony Towns needs to prove something there. Needs to prove something offensively, in addition to being more of a five rather than a four like he was in Minnesota last season. At number 16, we got Ja Morant. I don't expect Ja and the Grizzlies to last very long versus Oklahoma City, but Ja belongs high on this list because he's back to playing like Ja. He looks more like Ja. He's logged over 30 pick and rolls per game ever since Taylor Jenkins got fired. Been dominant, downhill, attacking. He's shooting the ball better than he has all season. We saw that in the play-in as well with some of those mid-range pull-ups and some threes to close the year as well. I'd have Ja lower if the playoffs had began a month ago, but that's because it was just a down year for him until recently, until the coaching change where he started getting rolling. And Ja looks back, so I think he belongs in the teens right now, considering his past elite postseason success. Unfortunately for Ja, he might be back, but the Grizzlies have been absolutely lapped by the Thunder, and they're going to get destroyed in the first round. I'm sorry, Grizzlies fans. Coming in at number 15, Tyrese Haliburton. This dude playing the best basketball of his life heading into the playoffs since the All-Star break. 68.1% true shooting, 64.7% true shooting all the way back since December because he's fully shaken off that mid-season hamstring injury. He looks fresh. He looks like Haliburton, and he's quietly had this just unbelievable playmaking season. It's not just 9.2 assists per game. He's also had only 1.6 turnovers per game. That's the second highest assist-to-turnover ratio ever for a player to average over 8 assists. Only Muggsy Bogues did it way back in the early 90s. And so with Haliburton, the playmaking, we know what he does. Everyone on Indiana is better because of him. Siakam two-man game stuff, pick and pops with Turner, kickouts to Nembhard or Nesmith. Haliburton's a maestro. And the Pacers' offense is crap without him. Goes from a 119 offensive rating with Haliburton on the floor to 111 when he's off the floor. But the playoffs are going to be a huge test for Halliburton's aggression. His usage rate during the season was only 21.6%. And a lot of the times he's way too passive looking for those passes. There was this really cool stat I saw from Kyler Taylor, a Pacers writer who found this, that when Haliburton makes his first shot, he averages 25.2 points on 16.5 field goals per 36 minutes. When Haliburton misses his first shot, he scores only 16.3 points on 13.7 field goals per 36 minutes. So he averages about 9 less points per game on about 3 shots less per game. When he just makes or misses the first shot of the game. Haliburton is so efficient as a scorer. The dude can get into pull-up threes. He can get into mid-range. He can get into floaters. He's crafty around the basket. In the playoffs, he needs to call his number more often. That's what could make him, that could really just what propels him to superstardom. He can't just be a playmaker. He needs to be a scorer when the games get tight for Indiana. It's going to happen in the first round against Milwaukee. And if they advance, it's only going to get harder in a second round series against Cleveland and then maybe a conference finals against Boston. He needs to be better as a scorer in order to elevate his own play. One guy to learn from comes in at number 14. James Harden comes in at number 14, and I think this is deserving, even though he's 35 years old at this point. He was an all-NBA guy, on my team at least. And you think about the story of the season with him. Kawhi Leonard misses most of the first half of the year. Harden carries a heavier load than he has in multiple years now at age 35. He's played the fifth most minutes of the entire NBA regular season, 79 games, the most since the 16-17 season. The dude was a workhorse start to finish all year long. And then ever since Kawhi got back, he looks closer to prime James Harden. So let's look at his before and after numbers since Kawhi started playing basically nightly in late February. Before that, he was averaging 21.6 points per game. And after that, 25.3 points per game. His at-rim field goal percentage is up. His paint field goal percentage is up. Those are floaters at 62% ever since late February. His mid-range is up. His three-point field goal percentage is up about 3 points at 37.5 since late February. And that's only a 25-game sample that we're looking at here. But Harden, he's been awesome for over a month now, and he's been great all year long. He's just been better since Kawhi got back. I know he's had choke jobs in the playoffs. I know he's had some real bummers, but the dude's also had some dominant moments in the prime of his career against the all-time great Warriors, and he's also had some great playoff moments in recent years as well. So he's not the best player on his team anymore. That's Kawhi Leonard. But I think that's a good thing for James Harden now, being that supporting guy, stepping up when needed, serving as a creator, but also scoring when he needs to alongside Kawhi Leonard. At number 13, got Evan Mobley. What a breakout regular season for Mobley. 18.5 points per game, 3.2 assists, 37% on threes on a career-high 3.2 attempts per game. Let's think about that number for a second. 3.2 attempts per game over the full year, but he's taken over 4 three-pointers per game ever since the All-Star break. And I think Kenny Atkinson, the Cavs head coach, is doing this because they're very clearly trying to prepare for the playoffs. Mobley's going to have to space the floor. He's going to have to do it effectively, and that's why they've ramped up that usage over the course of the season. And plus, when he's spacing, that's what allows him to attack closeouts, create for himself or for others more often as well. But with him, the big critical playoff test, physicality, he struggled with it in the past against the Knicks, really started to figure things out last year against the Celtics, though, and he carried that into the season. So he needs to keep building. We know he provides elite defense. He might win Defensive Player of the Year, guards every inch of the floor. He's got a foundation, a baseline of what provides offensive value and defensive value. That's why I have him in my top 15 here at number 13. But the shooting and some of the higher volume stuff is what could really, really help support Cleveland and help them beat Boston. Coming in at number 12, big proven player here. Jimmy Butler is here at number 12 because playoff Jimmy mode has been activated. His last four games, 30 points per game, 7.3 assists per game, 4.3 boards per game, and 2 steals per game. Elite defense overall for Golden State. And he stepped up his scoring as well, which is important. I was worried after Steph only had 3 points a couple weeks ago against Houston, and Butler did nothing. But ever since then, it's like the switch flipped in his head and he's like, okay, time to treat these games like the playoffs. And so we know what Jimmy can do in the playoffs. That's why he belongs here. And all year long, he's been awesome with the Warriors. They have a plus 8.6 net rating with him on the floor. And if he continues to be this hyper efficient player, living at the line all game and then closing games as this versatile piece, they use him like a queen on the chessboard. He's screening sometimes, playmaking and cutting. He does all these little things in the Warriors' half-court offense in addition to his defense. He's going to be a pivotal player for them, obviously. That's why they got him. The question's going to be, how does he shoot? 27.9% of his threes have been made this year with the Warriors. The Rockets are going to sag off of him. They're going to pack the paint. They're going to dare somebody to shoot, and odds are that's going to be Jimmy. But at 35 years old, still chasing a ring, sure as hell going to be nice to have Stephen Curry and Draymond Green by your side on that journey if they can get through the Rockets in round one. Coming in at number 11, Donovan Mitchell, because in 54 career playoff games, Mitchell has averaged 28.1 points per game, 55.9% true shooting, which is about equal efficiency to what he's done in his regular seasons in the past, because that's important. He doesn't dip in efficiency. He stays about the same while also raising his volume. We know he's capable of doing that, and he's also been posting his career best efficiency in his years with Cleveland. And now he's got the best team of his career, a high 60s win team with guys who have developed a ton of depth, guys who can compensate for his playmaking with Garland, guys who can cover for him on defense, Mobley and Allen in the front court. Allen, by the way, who arguably belonged in this top 40. A bunch of wings, Dean Wade, Max Strus, DeAndre Hunter, Isaac Okoro. The list is long. Guys who can cover for him on defense. Maybe this is the year that Mitchell not just replicates his efficiency offensively, but raises it in the postseason. And Cleveland might need that in a series against Boston way down the line. At number 10, we got Jalen Brunson. Brunson's awesome. Everybody knows this. 26 points per game, gets wherever he wants on the floor. He's an elite shooter. He's an elite pull-up guy. He gets to the rim at will. He's this crafty below-the-rim finisher, draws a ton of fouls. I know people hate the grifting. So be it. He's a good playmaker. He's a great scorer. 59% of the time he's on the floor, the ball is in his hands. We know these things about Jalen Brunson, okay? I just hope the Knicks turn down that usage a little bit, you know, go from a 10 to a 9, sometimes a 7, sometimes an 8, because we saw OG Anunoby without Jalen Brunson out there for a few weeks, what he could do. We know Karl Anthony Towns is capable of more. We know Mikal Bridges can create a little bit too. So I think the Knicks would really benefit from better balance with other guys creating other sources of offense. These are what the best teams in basketball do. It's what Boston did last year in their finals run. It's what the Knicks have a roster that can be capable of doing, but they just don't. Thibodeau leans on Brunson too much, even though he's an elite knockdown shooter. I hope they get Brunson some of those easy chances, and that's what the Knicks are going to need to make a deep run. At number 9, Kawhi Leonard. Kawhi Leonard, he's deserving here, man. I know he's injury prone. I know that's the big question with him, but there's no denying what this dude can do when he's on the floor. From 2017 through 2023, he played 62 career playoff games, 29.6 points per game, 56% from two, 39% from three, 89% from the line, plus 4.5 assists, plus 8.5 rebounds because Boardman gets paid. The dude's awesome. Obviously, he gets injured. Obviously. It's been 3 straight postseasons. He doesn't cross the finish line. Not a lot of trust that he can do it this year. But, you know, maybe fourth time will be the charm. Maybe he'll have another, you know, story like he did in Toronto where he limps to the finish line, but he gets there and he leads his team to a championship. Because right now, Kawhi Leonard looks like one of the best players in the world. He looks absolutely unbelievable. The way he's moving, he looks like he's in his prime right now. And so that's why he might be a little bit higher than you expect, because he deserves to be in the top 10, because this list is about right now. Who would you want today? I'd like to hear the argument from anybody watching or listening to this video. Who would you take behind him, ahead of Kawhi Leonard? You're drafting every player. They're stacked up one by one. Who are you drafting ahead of Kawhi Leonard? You're telling me you take Tyrese Halliburton ahead of Kawhi Leonard today? You take Jalen Brunson ahead of Kawhi Leonard? You take Kat? You take Jimmy Butler? Maybe you can make an argument, but I'm not seeing it, because Kawhi Leonard is a proven champion, and the only question with him is health. And so that's why I have him at number 9, and he definitely belongs in the top 10. The guys ahead of him, well, tougher argument to put Kawhi ahead of them because of the injury concerns. Starting with number 8, I get Anthony Edwards at number 8, because with Ant this year, look, we know he's dominant. He became an elite shooter. He did everything he could to lead the NBA in three-pointers made, and he did it. What a story. This is a chance for Ant to prove everything. You get through, in your first round series, you get through Luka and LeBron, and then in the second round, you get through Stephen Curry and the Warriors or an elite Rockets defense, and then in the conference finals, who knows who it'll be. Could be OKC, a 68-win team, or Jokic in Denver. It could be Kawhi and the Clippers, their elite defense as well. If you get through this gauntlet, like, people are going to be throwing out the MJ comparisons again. It'll be a repeat of last year. I just hope Ant doesn't have a hard fall and not look like himself at the finish line. But for Ant, the reason why this is going to be such a really tough test is because he's going to have to do it under a lot of pressure. Edwards is going to see two on the ball a lot. He was blitzed more than anyone in the pick and roll this season, 15% of the time. And when you plot the 25 highest volume pick and roll players this season, Ant, Stephen Curry, and Luka Doncic are the only three players that were blitzed over 10% of the time. But Ant is the outlier at 15%. That's double guys like Trae Young and James Harden. It's triple guys like LaMelo Ball and Tyrese Halliburton. And for Ant, last year in the playoffs, he got blitzed even more than he did during the season, so that could happen again. If Ant can handle the heat and he can pick his spots as a scorer and as a playmaker, then the Wolves could get through anybody. but that's not going to be easy. It's just not going to be easy. I'm not picking Minnesota to win the finals. I think they need another creator behind him that's better than Julius Randle, who I do not trust, who I do not have in the top 40, who has been a playoff stinker in the past for the Knicks. I don't trust he'll be able to get it done for the Wolves until he actually proves it. But Anthony Edwards is that guy. He just needs the help. Coming in at number 7, we get Jason Tatum. On one hand, with Tatum, he won a ring. He was dominant defensively. He showed his versatility, defended every position. He rebounds at an elite level for his position. He progressed as a playmaker as well. Last year in the finals, he averaged 7.2 assists per game. On the other hand, he still has something to prove because he didn't score the way we know he can. He shot below 30% from three for the whole playoffs. Last regular season, let's compare this to the playoffs. Last regular season, he shot 45.7% on isolations and post-ups. Last playoffs, that dropped to 35.6%. And this happened annually with him in postseasons as an iso scorer and as a post scorer. Will it this year? He shot very comparably this year to what he did last year in the regular season. 43.7% on isos and post-ups. That's good. That's 75th percentile, according to Synergy. Will that drop again? Or will he raise his play in the postseason? Will he be able to shoot threes effectively? He's had a dip in recent months for Boston as well. We know he does everything else. We know he defends. We know he rebounds. We know he passes. We know all of these things. That's why he's in the top 10. He's an awesome player. He's one of the most well-rounded players in basketball. But would put him in the top 5 or even the top 4 is the scoring translating on the biggest stage. And I'm sure Tatum, after this whole past year, he doesn't win finals MVP. He doesn't play for Team USA. And now he enters the postseason on a 2 seed with a chance to go back-to-back. I know he still has something to prove. And this could be the postseason that he does it. Coming in at number 6, we get Stephen Curry. Because over the final 30 games of the season, he was back to being Steph. Best he's been all year. 27.8 points per game. 39.8% from three. Obviously, he's a lights-out three-point shooter. Hit tons of back-breaking shots, whizzing around screens, moving constantly, creates chaos at every single moment on the floor. But the reason why earlier in the year I was concerned about him, concerned about the Warriors, was because his athleticism, it just looked degraded. He didn't look the same on defense, and he had a knee issue that he was dealing with, but it also affected him a lot offensively. He was getting to the rim at a career low rate, and he was also finishing at a career low rate as well. He made only 51% of his unassisted shots at the rim before they got Jimmy Butler. His career average is 60%. The last 30 games of the season, he's at 61%. So Steph is not only just lights out from three, we know he's drawing more fouls as well. Jimmy Butler's rubbing off on him, but he's also finishing 61% of unassisted shots at the rim. He looks more like his prime self, not just because of the jumper, but because of the defense and the at-rim finishing. That's one of the reasons why to be bullish on the Warriors and on Stephen Curry. At number 5, LeBron James. 24.4 points per game, 8.2 assists, 7.8 rebounds at age 40. LeBron's still a top 5 player, still scores a ton in a variety of ways as well. He's evolved there. Aside from the on-ball creation, he's now an elite shooter, made 41% of his catch-and-shoot threes. He's an active cutter playing alongside Luka. He's a screener, gets mismatches for the Lakers. He gets iso and post-up mismatches, whether it's for himself or Luka. When he screens for Luka, the Lakers are scoring 1.6 points per screen. That is just an unbelievable number, and they're going to go to that over and over and over again in the postseason, regardless of their opponent. And on top of that, for stretches of this season on defense, he looked like Draymond. And I know it was up and down for him earlier in the year, not quite the same. Post-injury, not quite the same. But when he was healthy, when he was on, he looked like an all-defensive caliber style player. And so when he's at peak levels, which he is right now, that's why he belongs in the top 5. You're taking LeBron 5th or higher if you're drafting players for the postseason, even at age 40. Even at age 40. And that's what makes the playoffs really interesting this year for the Lakers, because LeBron, for the first time in his whole career, he's not the best player on his team every single night. Sometimes it's going to be Luka. because Luka comes in at number 4 in these rankings. We know who Luka is. Age 21 and 22, he goes toe-to-toe against Kawhi Leonard and the Clippers. Age 23, he drags the Mavericks to the Western Conference Finals. Age 25, he leads them to the NBA Finals. It's a pretty safe bet that your team is going to go far with Luka, especially given the level he's playing at right now. Start of the year, not so great. Obviously, the Mavericks trade him. Nico Harrison believes defense wins championships. You got to give it to him. The Lakers are the beneficiary here. And Luka, February, not so great. Since March, 31-8-8, elite efficiency. And so for the Lakers come postseason time, they're going to have LeBron and Luka on the floor together most of the time, around 70% of their minutes during the season. I'd expect that to be about roughly the same during the playoffs. But in those 30% of the times that he's on the floor without LeBron, look at these numbers without LeBron on the floor. Per 75 possessions, Luka without LeBron, 38.3 points, 10 boards, 8.8 assists on 59.6% true shooting. That's insane. It's crazy. And like those numbers include the stretches where he wasn't his full self either. Like the dude has been unbelievable. Like I watched the Lakers and I still can't believe they have Luka and LeBron James. It's just like it still just breaks my brain. I still can't believe it. And like the playoffs, first round series against the Wolves, Luka versus Rudy Gobert again, screaming in his face after a step back jumper. Get a chance to see that again in a Lakers jersey. I can't believe it. It's just so weird to me. This is actually a thing. At number 3, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. SGA received my vote, so Thunder fans might be a little bit surprised and maybe angry about this, but again, it's a regular season award. Jokic and Giannis are ahead of him. SGA still needs to prove that he can lead his team to a finals. That's where best player in the world honors change, in my opinion. When I moved Jokic ahead of Giannis years ago, it's when he did it in the playoffs. SGA has an opportunity to do that in this postseason. And of course, he did show that he can dominate the postseason. You're feeling bullish about OKC. You're feeling bullish about SGA because he did dominate in his 10 postseason games. OKC didn't lose in 6 games to Dallas because of SGA falling off. He showed, if anything, that he can reach a higher level, okay? So we know his baseline, 32.7 points, 6.4 assists, 5 boards, 2.7 steals and blocks combined. He had a historic season. Those numbers, plus 60% true shooting, was only matched 5 times by 2 players. Michael Jordan matched those numbers 3 times. James Harden did it twice. And neither MJ nor Harden led their team to over 55 wins. SGA led OKC to 68 wins. And he was excellent defensively. Like most high-volume star players, their weak links defensively, SGA was not. So you're betting on SGA to move up to 2 or even to 1 on this list. But for now, I feel good keeping him at number 3 to stick with my philosophy that you don't move ahead of those guys for the postseason until you do it in the postseason. So SGA getting to a third round, getting to the finals, or even winning a finals, that's what's going to move him up. Right now at number 2, got Giannis Antetokounmpo. Things felt like they were collapsing around Giannis this season. Chris Middleton, aging, gets traded. Damian Lillard, blood clot, uncertain postseason future. Bobby Portis, suspension as well. But the Bucks still win 48 games because Giannis himself still remains at an MVP level. And in the final month of the year, he might be better than ever, at least the way he's been playing lately. The Bucks surround him with 4 shooters on the floor. Last 6 games, small sample, whatever, let's ignore that. Last 6 games, 31.8 points, 12 boards, 11.8 assists per game, and only 1.7 turnovers. A 7.2 assist to turnover ratio for Giannis. Scoring at an elite level, old news. Rebounding, old news. The playmaking, spraying the ball around the floor to shooters, playing composed, making smart decisions, carrying a heavier load, averaging almost 100 touches per game. When Dame returns, this formula still needs to be the thing. They need to treat Giannis as the primary creator that he's looked like as of late, because it's working. With shooters around him on the floor, defenders around him on defense, Giannis looks like the best player in the world. these last six games. And if he carries that into the postseason against a really tough Pacers opponent, if they beat the Pacers with Dame missing who knows what amount of time, with the Pacers being as great as they've been since mid-December, Giannis and the Bucks, if they do that, I don't think you can completely outrule them winning a second-round matchup against Cleveland. I don't think you can. We'll see if he can do it, though, but Giannis for now stays at number two. At number one, no surprises here, Nikola Jokic, 29.6 points, 12.7 boards, 10.2 assists per game, the second most efficient season of his career. Back in 22-23, he was more efficient, but he took five less shots that year. This year, he's been higher volume and elite efficiency. He improved his three-point shooting percentage to 41.7% on 4.7 attempts per game. Those are both career highs. Jokic undeniably had one of the greatest offensive seasons ever, but is he going to get support in the playoffs from Jamal Murray? Is Murray going to be back to being the guy we've seen in the past? Will the Nuggets be better defensively? They had a bottom 10 defensive rating this season. Jokic was a part of that. Will he be able to step up his play? Regardless, he's still the best player in the world. People are going to be coming for that crown this postseason. But for now, Jokic comes in at number one. Well, that's the top 40, folks. Let me know in the comments below what you think. What do you agree with the most? What do you disagree with the most? And I look forward to seeing who moves up these rankings, who moves down, who proves themselves, who of these young guys show what they're capable of doing, and maybe some of the old guys look like I have them ranked too high. I'm leaning too much in the past. So we'll see how the playoffs play out. I'm stoked. I think the West is going to be unbelievable, and I think the East later rounds are going to be awesome too. So, hey, stay tuned on Yahoo Sports. We get a ton of podcasts over on YouTube. My show, The Kevin O'Connor Show, will be going two or three times per week throughout the entire postseason. We'll be talking NBA playoffs, breaking down the games with some of the top minds across the league. We'll be talking NBA draft a lot as well. We're not going to be ignoring the teams that aren't in the postseason. You're going to get coverage as well. So stay tuned on The Kevin O'Connor Show for a whole lot coming up. The whole rest of the NBA playoffs, the real season, is just beginning. Thanks for watching.